Chapter 34. I had assumed that the priest and I would step out of the light into the abandoned city of Endymion, probably right next to the old poet's tower. But when we blinked away the glare of the void, it was quite dark, and we were on a rolling plain with wind whistling through grass that came to my knees and to Father DeSoya's cassocked thighs. "Did we do it?" asked the Jesuit in excited tones. "Are we on Hyperion? It doesn't look familiar, but then I saw only portions of the northern continent more than 11 standard years ago. Is this right? The gravity feels as I remember it. The air is sweeter." I let my eyes adapt to the night for a moment. Then I said, "This is right." I pointed skyward. "Those constellations? That's the Swan. Over there are the Twin Archers. That one is actually called the Water Bearer, but Grandam always used to kid that it was named Rawl's Caravan after a little cart I used to pull around." I took a breath and looked at the rolling plain again. "This was one of our favorite camping spots," I said. "Our nomad caravans. When I was a child." I went to one knee to study the ground in the starlight. "Still rubber tire marks. A few weeks old. The caravans still come this way, I guess." DeSoya's cassock made rustling sounds in the grass as he strode back and forth, as restless as a penned night hunter. "Are we close?" he asked. "Can we walk to Martin Silenus's place from here?" "About 400 clicks," I said. "We're on the eastern expanse of the moors, south of the beak. Uncle Martin is in the foothills of the Pinion Plateau." I winced inwardly when I realized that I had used Aenea's pet name for the old poet. "Whatever," said the priest impatiently. "In which direction shall we set out?" The Jesuit was actually ready to start walking, but I put my hand back on his shoulder to stop him. "I don't think we'll have to hike," I said softly. Something was occluding the stars to the southeast, and I picked up the high hum of turbofans above the wind whistle. A minute later we could see the blinking red and green navigation lights as the skimmer turned north across the grassland and obscured the Swan. "Is this good?" asked DeSoya, his shoulder tensing slightly under my palm. I shrugged. "When I lived here it wouldn't be," I said. "Most of the skimmers belong to the Pax, to Pax Security to be exact." We waited only another moment. The skimmer landed, the fans hummed down and died, and the left bubble at the front hinged open. The interior lights came on. I saw the blue skin, the blue eyes, the missing left hand, the blue right hand raised in greeting. "It's good," I said. "How is he?" I asked Abetic as we flew southeast at 3,000 meters. From the paling above the pinions on the horizon, I guessed that it was about an hour before dawn. "He's dying," said the android. For a moment, then, we flew in silence. Abetic had seemed delighted to see me again, although he stood awkwardly when I hugged him. Androids were never comfortable with such shows of emotion between servants and the humans they had been biofactured to serve. I asked as many questions as I could in the short flight time we had. He had immediately expressed his regrets about Aenea's death, which gave me the opportunity to ask the question uppermost in my mind. "Did you feel the shared moment?" "Not exactly, Emendymion," said the android, which did not serve to enlighten me at all. But then Abetic was catching us up with the last standard year and month on Hyperion since that moment. Martin Silenus had been, just as Aenea had known he would be, the beacon relay for the shared moment. Everyone on my homeworld had felt it. The majority of the born-again and Pax military had deserted outright, seeking out communion to rid themselves of the cruciform parasites and shunning the Pax loyalists. Uncle Martin had supplied the wine and blood, both out of his personal stock. He had been hoarding the wine for decades and drawing off blood since his communion with the 10-year-old Aenea 250 years earlier. The few remaining Pax loyalists had fled in the three remaining starships, and their last occupied city, Port Romance, had been liberated 4 months after the moment. From his continued seclusion in the old university city of Endymion, Uncle Martin had begun broadcasting Old Hollows of Aenea, Aenea as a youngster I had never met, explaining how to use their new access to the void which binds and pleading for nonviolence. The millions of indigenes and ex-Pax faithful, who were just discovering the voices of their dead and the language of the living, did not disobey her wishes. A. Bettick also informed me that there was a single gigantic Templar tree ship in orbit now, the Sequoia Semper Virens, and that it was captained by the true voice of the Star Tree, Ket Rostine, and was carrying several of our old friends, including Rachel, Theo, the Dorji Famo, the Dalai Lama, and the ousters Navsan Hamnim and Sion Quintana Kaan. George Sarong and Jigme Norbu were also aboard. Rostine had been radioing the old poet for permission to land for 2 days, said A. Bettick, but Silenus had refused, saying that he did not want to see them or anyone else until I arrived. Me? I said. Martin Silenus knew I was coming? Of course, said the android, and left it at that. How did Rachel and the Dorji Famo and the others get to the tree ship? I said. Did the Sequoia Semper Virens stop by Barnard's world and invite his gray Balianus B and the other systems to pick them up? It is my understanding, M. Endymion, that the ousters traveled with the tree ship from what remains of the biosphere Star Tree, which we were fortunate enough to visit. The others, as I am given to understand, from M. Rostine's increasingly frustrated transmissions to M. Silenus, free cast to the tree ship, much as you have cast here to us. I sat straight up in my seat. This was shocking news. For some reason, I had assumed that I was the only person clever enough, blessed enough, or whatever enough to have learned the free casting trick. Now I learned that Rachel and Theo and the old abbot had done so. The young Dalai Lama and, well, a Dalai Lama maybe, and Rachel and Theo had been Aenea's earliest disciples. But George and Jigme? I admit to feeling a bit deflated, yet also excited by the news. Thousands of others, perhaps those at first whom Aenea had known and touched and taught directly, must be on the verge of their first steps. And then, the mind again reeled at the thought of all those billions traveling freely wherever they wished. We landed at the abandoned mountain city just as the sky was paling in earnest to the east of the peaks. I jumped out of the skimmer, holding the scriber against my side as I ran up the tower steps and leaving the android and the priest behind in my eagerness to see Martin Silenus. The old man had to be happy to see me, and grateful that I had done so much to help meet all his impossible requests. Aenea rescued from the original Pax ambush in the Valley of the Time Tombs, now the Pax destroyed, the corrupt church toppled, the Shrike evidently stopped from hurting Aenea or attacking humanity, just as the old poet had requested that last drunken evening we had spent together here more than a standard decade earlier. He would have to be happy and grateful.
It took you goddamn fucking long enough to get your lazy ass here, said the mummy in the web of life support tubes and filaments. I thought I'd have to go out and drag you back from wherever you were lazing around like some fucking 20th century welfare queen.
The emaciated thing in the hover bed at the locus of all the machines, monitors, respirators, and android nurses did not look much like the pulsing rejuvenated old man I had said goodbye to less than a decade of mine and only 2 waking years of his ago. This was a corpse that had neglected to be buried. Even his voice was an electronic restructuring of his sub-vocalized gasps and rattles.
Are you finished fucking gawking, or do you want to buy another ticket for the freak show? Asked the voice synthesizer above the mummy's head.
Sorry, I mumbled, feeling like a rude child caught staring.
Sorry doesn't feed the bulldog, said the old poet. Are you going to report to me or just stand there like the indigene hick you are?
Report? I said, opening my hands and setting the scriber on a table tray. I think you know the essential things.
Essential things?
Roared the synthesizer, interpreting the torrent of chokes and rattles.
What the fuck do you know about essential things, boy?
The last of the android nurses had scurried out of sight. I felt a flush of anger. Perhaps age had rotted the old bastard's mind as well as his manners, if he ever had any manners. After a minute of silence broken only by the rasp of the mechanical bellows below the bed, bellows that moved air in and out of the dying man's useless lungs, I said, "Report." "All right." "Most of the things you asked are done, M. Silenus. Anea ended the rule of the Pax in the church. The Shrike seems to have disappeared. The human universe has changed forever."
"The human universe has changed forever," mimicked the old poet in his synthesizer's attempt at a sarcastic falsetto. "Did I fucking ask you, or the girl for that matter, to change the fucking universe for fucking ever?"
I thought back to our conversations here a standard decade earlier. "No," I said at last.
"There you go," snarled the old man. "Your brain cells are beginning to stir again. Jesus H. Christ, kid, I think that Schrodinger litter box made you stupider than you were."
I stood and waited. Perhaps if I waited long enough, he would just die quietly.
"What did I ask you to do before you left, boy wonder?"
he demanded in the tone of a furious schoolmaster. I tried to remember details other than his demand that Anea and I destroy the Pax's iron rule and topple a church that controlled hundreds of worlds. The Shrike. Well, that wasn't what he meant. By touching the void which binds rather than my own fallible memory, I finally retrieved his last words before I had flown off on the hawking mat to meet the girl.
"Get going," the old poet had said. "Give my love to Anea. Tell her that her Uncle Martin is waiting to see old Earth before he dies. Tell her that the old fart is eager to hear her expound the meanings of all motions, shapes, and sounds.
The essence of things." "Oh," I said aloud, "I'm sorry that Anea is not here to talk to you."
"So am I, boy," whispered the old man in his own voice. "So am I. And don't bring up that thermos of ashes the priest is carrying. That isn't what I meant when I said I wanted to see my niece again before I died." I could only nod, feeling the pain in my throat and chest. "What about the rest?" he demanded. "You going to carry out my final request? Or just let me die while you stand there with your big disciple's thumb up your stupid ass?"
"Final request?" I repeated. My IQ seemed to drop 50 points when I was in the presence of Martin Silenus. The voice synthesizer sighed.
"Give me your stylus scriber there if you want me to spell it out in big block letters for you, boy. I want to see old Earth before I croak. I want to go back there. I want to go home."
In the end, it was decided that we should not move him from his tower. The android medics conferred with the ouster medics, who finally were permitted to land, who conferred with the auto-surgeon aboard the consul's ship, which was parked just beyond the tower, exactly where Abetic had landed it some 2 months earlier, after paying his time debt for translation from Pacham's system, which conferred electronically with the medical monitor surrounding the poet, as it had been constantly, and the verdict remained the same. It would probably kill him to take him aboard either the consul's ship or the tree ship by removing him from his tower and submitting him to even the most subtle changes of gravity or pressure. So we brought the tower and a large chunk of Endymion with us. Ket Rostin and the ousters handled the details, bringing down half a dozen ergs from their lair on the giant tree ship. I estimated later that about 10 hectares actually rose into the air during that lovely Hyperion sunrise, including the tower, the consul's parked spaceship, the pulsing Mobius cubes that had transported the ergs, the parked skimmer, the kitchen and laundry annexes next to the tower, part of the old chemistry building on the Endymion campus, several stone dwellings, precisely half of the bridge over the Pinion River, and a few million metric tons of rock and subsoil. The liftoff was undetectable. The containment fields and lift fields were handled so perfectly by the Urgs and their Auster and Templar handlers that there was no hint of movement whatsoever, except for the morning sky becoming an unblinking starfield in the circular opening of Uncle Martin's tower above our heads, and the hollows in the sick room that showed our progress. Standing in that room, the stars burning and rotating overhead, A. Bedick, Father DeSoya, a few other android nurses, and I watched those direct-feed hollows as I held the old man's hand. Endymion, our world's oldest city and the source of my indigene family's name, slid silently up through sunrise and atmosphere, to be embraced by the 10 kilometers of perfect tree ship waiting for us in high orbit. The Sequoia Sempervirens had parted its branches to make a perfect berth for us, so we could walk from Hyperion soil to the great bridges and branches and walkways of the ship with no sense of transition. Then the tree ship turned out toward the stars.
"You will have to do the next part, Rall," said the Dorji Famo. "M. Silenus will not survive a Hawking drive shift or the fugue or the time debt necessary."
"This is a damned big tree ship," I said. "Lots of people and machines aboard. You'll help, I hope?"
"Of course," said the tall woman with the wild gray hair.
"Yes,"
said the Dalai Lama and George and Jigme.
"We'll help," said Rachel as she stood next to Theo. Both women looked older.
"We will also try," said Father DeSoya, speaking for Ket Rostine and the others gathered near. High on the bridge of the ship, while A. Bedick tended to his former master some 100 meters below, the Dorji Famo, Rachel, Theo, the Dalai Lama, George Jigme, Father DeSoya, the Templar captain, and the others held hands. I completed the rough circle. We closed our eyes and listened to the stars.
I had expected the sky river of stars that was the Lesser Magellanic Cloud to hang above the tree ship as we emerged from light, but it was obvious that we were still in the Milky Way, still in our arm of the Milky Way, not that many light years from Hyperion system, if the familiar constellations were to be believed. We had gone somewhere, but the world that burned above the branches was not the sea blue and cloud white of old Earth, or even an Earth-like planet, but was a red and oceanless desert world with scattered pocks of volcanic or impact crater acne and a gleaming white polar cap.
"Mars," said A. Bedick. "We have returned to old Earth system near the star named Sol." All of us heard the void voice resonance of Fedmon Kassad on that world. We freecast down, found him, explained the voyage. He did not need the explanation, because he had heard us coming through his own listening, and brought him back to the Sequoia Sempervirens with us. Martin Silenus sent up word that he wanted to speak to his old pilgrimage partner, and I walked the stairways and bridges to the tower with the soldier.
"Old Earth system is secure, just as the one who teaches commanded me," said Kassad as we stepped onto the Hyperion soil where the fragment of city nestled in the tree ship's branches. "No Pax ships have tested our defenses for 10 months. No one in system, not even our own warships, will be allowed to approach closer than 20 million kilometers to Old Earth."
"To Old Earth?" I repeated. I stopped in my tracks. Kassad stopped and turned his thin, dark visage toward me.
"You don't know?"
he said. The soldier pointed skyward, straight up toward where the tree ship was accelerating under smooth, Erg-managed full thrust. It looked like a double star, as all planets with one large moon look, but I could see the pale glow of Luna, smaller, colder, and the warm blue and white pulse of life that was old Earth. A. Bedick joined us at the entrance to the tower.
"When was it? When did they...
How? When did it return?" I said, still looking up at old Earth as it grew into a true sphere.
"At the time of the shared moment," said Kassad.
He brushed red dust from his black uniform, preparing himself to see the old poet.
"Does everyone know?" I said.
Poor dumb Roland Dimion, always the last one to get the word.
"Now they do," said Colonel Fedmon Cassad.
The three of us went up to see the dying man. Martin Silenus was in good humor upon meeting his old friend after almost 280 years of separation.
"So your black killer soul is going to become the seed crystal when they build the shrike a millennium hence, hey?"
cackled the old man through his laboring speech synthesizer.
"Well, thanks a shitload, Cassad."
The soldier frowned down at the grinning mummy.
"Why aren't you dead, Martin?"
the colonel said at last.
I am, said Silenus, coughing. "I quit breathing ages and neons ago. They just haven't been smart enough to push me over and bury me yet."
The synthesizer did not try to articulate the chokes and rattles that followed.
"Did you ever finish your worthless prose poem?"
asked the soldier, as the old man continued to cough, sending the web of tubes and wires shaking.
"No,"
I said, speaking for the coughing form in the bed. "He couldn't."
"Yes,"
said Martin Silenus clearly through his throat mic.
"I did."
I just stood there.
"Actually," cackled the poet, "he finished it for me."
The bony arm with its wrapping of parchment flesh rose slightly from the bed. A thumb distorted by arthritis jerked in my direction. Colonel Cassad gave me a glance. I shook my head.
"Don't be so fucking dense, boy,"
said Martin Silenus with what translated as an affectionate tone over the speaker.
"See your scriber anywhere?"
I whirled and looked at the bedside tray where I had left it earlier. It was gone.
"All printed out. About 1 billion backup memories cut. Sent it out on the datasphere before we cast here,"
rasped Silenus.
"There is no datasphere," I said.
Martin Silenus laughed himself into a coughing fit. Eventually, the synthesizer translated some of those coughs as,
"You aren't just dumb, boy, you're helpless. What do you think the void is? It's the goddamn universe's goddamn datasphere, boy. I've been listening to it for centuries before the kid gave me communion to do it with nanotech bugs in me. That's what writers and artists and creators do, boy. Listen to the void and try to hear dead folks' thoughts. Feel their pain. The pain of living folks, too. Finding a muse is just an artist or holy man's way of getting a foot in the void which binds front door. Ania knew that. You should have, too."
"You had no right to transmit my narrative," I said. "It's mine. I wrote it. It's not part of your cantos."
If I had known for sure which tube passing to him was his oxygen hose, I would have stepped on it till the rattling stopped.
"Bullshit, boy," said Martin Silenus. "Why do you think I sent you on this 11-year vacation?"
"To rescue Ania," I said.
The poet cackled and coughed.
"She didn't need rescuing, Rawl. Hell, the way I saw it while it was happening, she pulled your worthless ass out of the fire more often than not. Even when the shrike was doing the saving, it was only because that girl child had tamed it for a bit."
The mummy's white eyes, with their video pickup glasses, turned toward Colonel Cassad.
"Tamed you, I mean, you once and future killing machine."
I stepped away from the bed and touched one of the biomonitors to steady myself. Overhead, in the wide circle that was the open top of the tower, old Earth grew large and round. Martin Silenus's voice called me back, almost taunting me.
"But you haven't finished it yet, boy. The cantos aren't done."
I stared at him across the few cold meters of distance.
"What do you mean, old man?"
"You've got to take me down there so we can finish it, Rawl. Together."
We could not freecast down to old Earth because there was no one there for me to use as a beacon for the casting. So we decided to use the ergs to land the entire slab of Endymion City. This might be fatal to the old poet, but the old poet had shouted at us to, for God's sake, shut the fuck up and get on with it. So we were. The Sequoia Semper Virens had been in low orbit around old Earth, or just plain Earth, as Martin Silenus demanded we call it, for several hours. The tree ship's optics, radar, and other sensors had shown a world empty of human life, but healthy with animals, birds, fish, plants, and an atmosphere free of pollution. I had planned to land at Taliesin West, but telescopes showed the buildings gone. Only high desert remained, probably just as it was in the final days before Earth was supposed to have fallen into the big mistake of 08 black hole. The Rome to which the second John Keats Seibert had returned was gone. All of the cities and structures, which I thought of as the lions and tigers and bears, experimental reconstructions, apparently, were gone. The Earth had been scrubbed clean of cities and highways and signs of humankind. It throbbed with life and health, as if awaiting our return. I was near the base of the consul's ship on Hyperion soil, in the city within the tree ship, surrounded by Aeneas' old friends and speaking aloud about the trip down, wondering who wanted to go and who should accompany us, thinking all the time only of the small metal canister in Father DeSoya's shoulder bag, when A. Bettick stepped forward and cleared his throat.
"Excuse me, M. Endymion. I do not mean to interrupt."
My old android friend seemed apologetic to the point of blushing under his blue skin, as he always did when he had to contradict one of us.
"But Emonia left specific instructions with me, should you return to old Earth, as you obviously have."
We all waited. I had not heard her give the android instructions on the Yggdrasil, but then things had been very loud and confused there toward the end. A. Bettick cleared his throat.
"Emonia specified that Ketros Steen should pilot the landing, if there were a landing, with four other individuals to disembark once landed, and asked me to apologize to all of you who wished to go down to old Earth immediately," he said. "Apologize especially," she said, "to dear friends such as M. Rachel, M. Theo, and the others who would be especially eager to see the planet. Emonia asked me to assure you that you would be welcome there 2 weeks from the landing day, on the last day before the tree ship would leave orbit. And she asked me to say that in 2 standard years, that is, 2 Earth years, of course, anyone who could cast here on their own would be welcome to visit old Earth."
2 years, I said. "Why a 2-year quarantine? A. Bettick shook his bald head.
"Emonia did not specify, M. Endymion. I am sorry."
I held up my hands, palms up.
"Well, who does get to go down now?" I asked. If my name was not on the list, I was going to go down anyway, Aeneas' last wishes or not. I'd use my fists to get aboard if need be, or hijack the consul's ship and land it, or freecast alone.
"You, sir," said A. Bettick. "She quite specifically mentioned you, M. Endymion. And M. Silenus, of course, Father DeSoya, and—" The android hesitated, as if embarrassed again.
"Go on," I said more sharply than I had intended.
"Me," said A. Bettick.
"You,"
I repeated. In a second, it made sense to me. The android had made our long trip out with us, had in fact spent more time with Aeneas than I had over the years because of the time debt involved in my solo odyssey. More than that, A. Bettick had risked his life for her, for us, and lost his arm in Nemesis' ambush on God's Grove so many years ago. He had listened to Aeneas' teachings even before Rachel and Theo, or I, had signed on as disciples. Of course she would want her friend A. Bettick there, when her few ashes were scattered in the breezes of old Earth. I felt ashamed for acting surprised.
"I am sorry," I said aloud. "Of course you should come."
A. Bettick nodded very slightly.
2 weeks, I said to the others, most of whose disappointment was visible on their faces.
"In 2 weeks we'll all be down there to look around, see what surprises the lions and tigers and bears have left for us." There were goodbyes, as old friends, Templars, Ousters, and others, left the soil of the city Endymion to watch from the tree ship's stairways and platforms. Rachel was the last to leave. To my surprise, she hugged me fiercely. "I hope to hell that you're worth it," she said in my ear. I had no idea what the feisty brunette was talking about. She, and most women, had always been a mystery to me. "All right," I said, after we had trooped up the stairs to Martin Silenus's bedside. I could see old Earth. Earth, above us. The view grew hazy and then disappeared as the containment fields merged, thickened, and then separated. The dry fields flowed, and the city pulled away from the tree ship. The Templar crew members and Ousters had rigged makeshift controls to the tower sick room, which, with all of Martin Silenus's medical machines hovering around, had become a very crowded space. I also thought that this was as good a place as any to sit out the Erg's attempt to land a mass of rock and grass, a city with a tower and a parked spaceship, and a half-stump of bridge leading nowhere, on a world that was three-fifths water and that had no spaceports or traffic control. At least, I thought, if we were going to crash and die, I might get a hint of the impending catastrophe from watching Ket Rosteen's impassive visage under his overhanging Templar hood in the seconds before impact. We did not feel entry into Earth's atmosphere. Only the gradual change of the circle of sky above us from star fields to blueness let us know that we had entered successfully. We did not feel the landing. One moment we were standing in silence, waiting, and then Ket Rosteen looked up from his displays and monitors, whispered something through the comm lines to his beloved Ergs, and said to us, "We're down." "I forgot to tell you where we should land," I said, thinking of the desert that had been Taliesin. It must be the place where Aenea had been happiest, where she would want those ashes, which I knew but still could not believe were hers, scattered in the warm Arizona winds. Ket Rosteen glanced toward the floating deathbed.
"I told him where to fucking land,"
rasped the old poet's voice synthesizer.
"Where I was born, where I planned to die. Now, will you all please pull your collective thumbs out and roll me out of here so that I can see the sky?"
A. Bettick unplugged all of Silenus's monitors, everything except the most essential life support equipment, and tied everything together within the same EM repulsor field. While we were on the tree ship, the androids and the Ouster crew clones and the Templars had built a long, gradual ramp from the top tower room down to the ground, then paved an exit walk to the edge of the city slab and beyond. All of this had landed intact, I noticed, as we accompanied the floating sickbed out into the sunlight and down. As we passed the consul's ebony spacecraft, a speaker on the hull of the ship said, "Goodbye, Martin Silenus. It was an honor knowing you." The ancient figure in the bed managed to lift one skeletal arm in a rather jaunty wave.
"See you in hell, ship."
We left the city slab, stepped off the paved ramp, and looked out at grasslands and distant bluffs not so different from my childhood moors, except for the line of forest to our right. The gravity and air pressure was as I remembered it from our 4-year sojourn on Earth, although the air was much more humid here than in the desert. "Where are we?" I asked of no one in particular. Ket Rosteen had stayed in the tower, and only the android, the dying poet, Father DeSoya, and I were outside now, in what seemed to be morning sunlight in an early spring day in the northern hemisphere.
"Where my mother's estate used to be,"
whispered Martin Silenus's synthesizer.
"In the heart of the heart of the North American Preserve."
A. Bettick looked up from checking the med unit's readouts. "I believe that this was called Illinois in the pre-Big Mistake days," he said. "The center of that state, I believe. The prairies have returned, I see. Those trees are elms and chestnut. Extinct by the 21st century here, if I am not mistaken. That river beyond the bluffs flows south-southwest into the Mississippi River. I believe you have, traversed a portion of that river, M. Endymion. Yes, I said, remembering the flimsy little kayak and the farewell at Hannibal, and Aeneas' first kiss. We waited. The sun rose higher. Wind stirred the grasses. Somewhere beyond the line of trees, a bird protested something as only birds can. I looked at Martin Silenus.
Boy, said the old poet's synthesizer, if you expect me to die on cue just to save you from a sunburn, fucking forget it. I am hanging on by my fingernails, but those nails are old and tough and long.
I smiled and touched his bony shoulder.
Boy, whispered the poet.
Yes, sir, I said.
You told me years ago that your old granny, Grandam you called her, had made you memorize the cantos till they were dribbling out your ears. Was that true?
Yes, sir.
Can you recollect the lines I wrote about this place, as it was back in my day?
I can try, I said. I closed my eyes. I was tempted to touch the void, to seek the sound of those lessons in Grandam's voice, in place of this struggle to recall them from memory. But instead, I did it the hard way, using the mnemonic devices she had taught me to recall distinct passages of verse. Standing there, eyes still closed, I spoke the passages I could recall. Fragile twilights fading from fuchsia to purple, above the crepe paper silhouettes of trees. Beyond the southwest sweep of lawn, skies as delicate as translucent china, unscarred by cloud or contrail. The pre-symphony hush of first light followed by the cymbal crash of sunrise. Oranges and russets igniting to gold, the long cool descent to green. Leaf shadow, shade, tendrils of cypress and weeping willow, the hushed green velvet of the glade. Mother's estate, our estate, 1,000 acres centered in 1,000,000 more. Lawns the size of small prairies with grass so perfect it beckoned a body to lie on it, to nap on its soft perfection. Noble shade trees making sundials of the earth. Their shadows circling in stately procession, now mingling, now contracting to midday, finally stretching eastward with the dying of the day. Royal oak, giant elms, cottonwood and cypress and redwood and bonsai, banyan trees lowering new trunks like smooth-sided columns in a temple roofed by sky, willows lining carefully laid canals and haphazard streams, their hanging branches singing ancient dirges to the wind. I stopped. The next part was hazy. I'd never enjoyed those fake lyrical bits of the cantos, preferring the battle scenes instead. I had been touching the old poet's shoulder as I recited, and I had felt it relax as I spoke. I opened my eyes, expecting to see a dead man in the bed. Martin Silenus gave me a satyr's grin.
Not bad, not bad, he rasped. Not bad for an old hack.
His video glasses turned toward the android and the priest.
See why I chose this boy to finish my cantos for me? He can't write worth shit, but he's got a memory like an elephant's.
I was about to ask what is an elephant when I glanced over at Abetic for no special reason. For one instant, after all my years of knowing the gentle android, I actually saw him. My mouth dropped slack. What? Asked Father DeSoya, his voice alarmed. Perhaps he thought I was having a heart attack. You, I said to Abetic. You're the observer. Yes, said the android. You're one of them. From them, from the lions and tigers and bears. The priest looked from me to Abetic, to the still grinning man in the bed, and then back at the android. I have never appreciated that choice of phrase of Emenea's, Abetic said very quietly. I have never seen a lion or tiger or bear in the flesh, but I understand that they share a certain fierceness which is alien to, the alien race to which I belong.
You took the form of an android centuries ago, I said, still staring in a deepening understanding that was as sharp and painful as a blow to the head.
You were there for all the central events. The rise of the hegemony, the discovery of the time tombs on Hyperion, the fall of the Farcasters. Good Christ, you were there for most of the last trike pilgrimage.
A. Betic bowed his bald head slightly.
If one is to observe, Emendymion, one must be in the proper place to observe.
I leaned over Martin Silenus's bed, ready to shake him alive for an answer if he had already died.
Did you know this old man?
Not before he left with you, Rawl, said the poet. Not until I read your narrative through the void and realized.
I took two steps back in the soft, high grass.
I was such an idiot, I said. I saw nothing, I understood nothing, I was a fool.
No, said Father DeSoya. You were in love. I advanced on A. Betic as if I was ready to throttle him if he did not answer immediately and honestly. Perhaps I would have.
You're the father, I said. You lied about not knowing where Aenea disappeared to for almost 2 years. You're the father of the child, of the next Messiah.
No, said the android calmly.
The observer with one arm, the friend who almost died with us a score of times.
No, he said again. I am not Aenea's husband. I am not the father.
Please, I said, my hands shaking, do not lie to me.
Knowing that he would not lie, had never lied. A. Betic looked me in the eye.
I am not the father, he said. There is no father now. There was never another Messiah. There is no child.
Dead. They're both dead. Her child, her husband, whoever, whatever he was. Aenea herself, my dear girl. My darling girl, nothing left, ashes.
Somehow, even as I had dedicated myself to finding the child, to pleading with the observer father to allow me to be this child's friend and bodyguard and disciple as I had been Aenea's, to using that newfound hope as a means of escaping the Schrödinger box, I had known deep in my heart that there was no child of my darling's alive in the universe. I would have heard that soul's music echoing across the void like a Bach fugue. No child. Everything was ashes.
I turned to Father DeSoya now, ready to touch the cylinder holding Aenea's remains. Ready to accept the fact of her being gone forever with the first touch of cold steel against my fingertips. I would go off alone, to find a place to spread her ashes. Walk from Illinois to Arizona if I had to. Or perhaps just to where Hannibal had been, where we first kissed. Perhaps this is where she was happiest while we were here.
Where is the canister? I said, my voice thick.
I did not bring it, said the priest.
Where is it? I said. I was not angry, just very, very tired. I'll walk back to the tower to get it.
Father Federico de Soya took a breath and shook his head. I left it in the tree ship, Rawl. I did not forget it. I left it there on purpose.
I stared at him, more puzzled than angry.
Then I realized that he, and A. Betic, and even the old poet in the bed, had turned their heads toward the bluffs above the river. It was as if a cloud had passed over, but then an especially bright ray of light had illuminated the grass for a moment. The two figures were motionless for long seconds, but then the shorter of the two forms began walking briskly toward us, breaking into a run. The taller figure was more recognizable at this distance, of course. Sunlight on its chrome carapace, the red eyes visibly glinting even at this distance, the gleam of thorns and spikes and razor fingers. But I had no time to waste looking at the motionless shrike. It had done its job. It had farcast itself and the person with it forward through time as easily as I had learned to cast through space. Aenea ran the last 30 meters. She looked younger, less worn by worry and events. Her hair was almost blonde in the sun and had been hastily tied back. She was younger, I realized, frozen in my place as she ran up to our small party on the hill. She was 20, 4 years older than when I had left her in Hannibal, but almost 3 years younger than when I saw her last. Ania kissed A. Bedick, hugged Father DeSoya, leaned into the bed to kiss the old poet with great gentleness, and then turned to me. I was still frozen in place. Ania walked closer and stood on tiptoe as she always had when she wanted to kiss me on the cheek. She kissed me gently on the lips. "I'm sorry, Rawl," she whispered. "I'm sorry this had to be so hard on you. On everyone. So hard on me." She stood there with the full foresight of the torture to come in Castel Sant'Angelo, with the Nemes things circling her naked body like carrion birds, with the images of the rising flames. She touched my cheek again. "Rawl, my dear, I'm here. This is me. For the next 1 year, 11 months, 1 week and 6 hours, I'll be with you. And I will never mention the amount of time again. We have infinite time. We'll always be together. And our child will be there with you as well." Our child. Not a messiah born out of necessity. Not a marriage with an observer. Our child. Our human, fallible, falling down and crying child. "Rawl," said Ania, touching my cheek with her work-calloused fingers. "Hello, kiddo," I said. And I took her in my arms.